everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Music, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Kimberly Mack, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Robert Fink about The Relentless Pursuit of Tone, Timbre in Popular Music, a collection he edited with Melinda Latour and Zachary Walmark. Robert Fink, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Robert, I wonder if you'd begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I have been doing musicology, which is my main field, for about, almost 30 years now. I was born in Boston, was a typical sort of what you might call classical music nerd, very interested in art music. I actually was a music major at college. I went to Yale as an undergrad and got heavily into sort of the cult of serious music. I have a master's degree in music theory from the Eastman School of Music, so I was still sort of pulling into that academic art music world. I did my PhD at Berkeley in California, and that is where things began to shift, as I guess often happens when people go to Berkeley. So my dissertation work and my early career work was on avant-garde contemporary music, in particular minimalist repetitive music. So I began to sort of move out and away from what you might consider the center of the canon of classical music. Got more interested in electronic music. That caused me to get interested in dance music, at which point I got interested in popular music. I began to teach classes on popular music and experienced the challenges of how to really communicate about that music, understand how it works. And for the last 20 years or so, I've been a professor of musicology at the University of California at Los Angeles, where I also am in charge of a small music industry program. So I split my time basically between some questions in high art music and the study of popular music. And that is sort of the backdrop to this collection. I've taught over the years, you know, dozens of graduate seminars for musicology students at UCLA on popular music. And this book actually comes out of a graduate seminar we did at UCLA. So it was a very successful class. And at the end of it, a couple of the students came up to me and proposed that maybe we had a collection that would be interesting to people because the topic was one that we found to be sort of revelatory. And I'll give you the quick justification of the seminar, and that'll also in some ways begin opening up the question of why this collection. The inspiration was something like this. If you were to teach a graduate seminar in musicology on classical music, and you talk about a piece of piano music, you can assume that your students know how a piano works, right? They may not be able to play the piano, they may not be able to repair the piano, but they have a basic idea of what's inside of a piano and how it works. And the same would be true for like a French horn or an oboe or a violin. This is sort of basic knowledge. But when we musicologists shifted over into talking about popular music, as we have done, it occurred to me that probably I could not count on my students to understand what's happening, say, inside an amplifier. You know, what happens between the time you plug a quarter-inch patch cable into the outside of an amplifier and when the sound comes out. That's not something you learn in undergrad, or it's not something that you learn within musicology. And there are kind of really interesting questions. You know, it's sort of clearly obvious to most musicologists that the cultural difference between playing a work on, say, the harpsichord versus playing it on the piano is important. But if you know anything about popular music production practices, or if you are a performer, if you're a player, you know that it's equally profound difference whether you decide to play using a Fender Telecaster or a Les Paul, right? Two different guitars. And the differences between those two instruments is so completely mysterious to within the world of academic musicology. So it actually started off, and we may come back to this later on, as really a kind of practical seminar on how do these things work. But the ruling sort of concept was this concept of tone. And that was where the seminar began, like tone in popular music. What is tone? And we can probably talk more about this, but it turns out that tone is a very complex kind of, if you will, transitional concept that links a lot of complicated values about musicality and expressiveness and authenticity to some relatively objective material facts about how many vacuum tubes do you have in your amplifier and, you know, did you use the right strings on your instrument, etc. So, yeah, that seminar turned out to be a blast. It really was. People got very heavily into it. And we found that it was incredibly revelatory to deeply dig into the actual sound generation that's coming off of the mode of, I don't know what you want to call it, the mode of production of popular music. Mm-hmm. So we got, you know, we got, how does an amplifier work? How does analog synthesis work? Can you hear the difference between various guitars? What about, I mean, people did all sorts of things in that class. They didn't all end up in the collection we're talking about, but a few of them did.
So then what was the next step? So you had a couple of your graduate students say, this might be a collection. So what happened? Because that was when, 2011?
Yes, it was quite a while ago. I got pitched this by the two graduate students, and they had both written excellent papers. And, you know, we agreed that, you know, it would be a doable project if the three of us worked on it. I, of course, would sort of, as a senior person, I could bring my connections to the table, and the three of us could actually split the editorial labor. So really, when we decided to do that, we did not say, well, let's just publish all the essays from all the people's essays in the seminar as the book. What we did is we actually started from sort of scratch, like who would we like to have in this book? Who would the dream team be? We basically, I think, went searching for three or four different types of people. Three or four types of people. And there were also specific issues and things that I knew we wanted to talk about. And I guess I can take those in order. We wanted some of the people who we had read in the seminar, right? So that there's a thing that, you know, I'd put a syllabus together and I had put in there the people who had done key work on tone and timbre and popular music. And so the logical thing was, let's get those people. Mm-hmm. And so people like Paul Tiberge, who had been working on this for decades, Simon Zagorski Thomas, you know, people who have actually, Cornelia Fales in ethnomusicology, these are people who had been working on the question of timbre for a long time and who were on our syllabus. We picked a few essays from the seminar itself. So the our essays, I had to write mine from scratch because I, of course, didn't assign myself a paper in my own seminar. But Zach and Mindy, as I call them, both brought their own essays in. And then we went searching for people who worked on a number of kind of specific issues that seemed particularly important in the kind of question of tone and timbre. And let me say parenthetically, this was not pitched to the publisher. It was not designed as one of those handbooks, right? So we didn't have really the aim to create a kind of formal laying out of a area of study in a kind of handbook way. We were really more looking for something that had a thesis and that had a wide range of individually interesting takes, right? So this is not like the Oxford Handbook of Tone and Timbre in Popular Music. In fact, the fact that it has a kind of slightly fanciful title, right? And I can tell you about, we can talk about where that title came from, maybe when we talk about the introduction to the book. But The Relentless Pursuit of Tone, in a way, says, no, this is not a kind of handbook that covers in a systematic way, like all of the aspects of a subdiscipline. We did try to get a broad range of essays and people, but it's really more, we were looking for individual people and individual questions that would be really interesting and suggestive. And where we went looking for that is people who had done foundational work in timbre studies in popular music. But we also looked for people who had done important work on musical instruments. So one set of people are people who had written very compellingly about various musical instruments. For instance, Steve Waxman was a logical choice to be in this book because he's the guy who wrote the book about the electric guitar. So since that's a powerful tone maker in pop music, we wanted a collection by him. We also got some people who were writing interesting things about the voice, the tone and the timbre of the voice, because as it turns out, we have a whole section in the book on voice, which at first might seem a little counterintuitive. You know, there's a sense when you think about tone and timbre, I think many of us think about tweaking the knobs and dials on an instrument, or, you know, I got to improve my tone. Maybe I'll buy a different piece of, you know, buy a different guitar. But, you know, your throat isn't really adjustable in that way. But in fact, the tone and timbre of the voice is actually some of the most culturally suggestive stuff. And in fact, the discourse around the sound of people's voices and how that sound relates to the embodiment turns out to be really powerful. So we got some people who work on voice and vocal production. We looked for people who were interested in, this is a new kind of field, which is the historical and aesthetic study of sound record production. So there are people now working on what you might call the art of record production. And we had some of the people really who are doing serious work on that. And then there were a few people who are working historically or working with specific artists or genres, you know, so that there are in a way there were, if I were to sort of wind that up into a ball, sometimes we were looking for pioneers in the field, people who had a really interesting rap on a particular instrument. Sometimes people who had spent a lot of time thinking about the details of production aesthetics in the studio. And then finally, people who had an interesting perspective on some kind of socio-cultural issue, often having to do with the voice. So that got us our group of of contributors, then it's a very broad group. My co-editors were no longer grad students by the time we started working on the book. They both graduated. Yay. But we did, in fact, have at least one current graduate student, and then some people who are super senior, you know, who have been working for decades and decades. So it's a very diverse group in terms of age. It's reasonably diverse in terms of discipline. So there are musicologists, ethnomusicologists, people who work in popular music studies. The afterword by Simon Frith brings in someone who I guess you'd call a sort of sociologist, really. Mm-hmm. It does have a certain amount of international flair, although it's really the Anglophone world, but there are a significant number of Brits in it because they do good work in popular music. So yeah, that's how it all came together. The last thing I'll say, there are a couple of things that I really knew I wanted in there. So I worked very hard to get an essay on auto-tune because I figured that's something everybody wanted to know about. So there were certain kind of contemporary issues. It was pretty clear we wanted something on auto-tune. We definitely wanted, some broadness of genre and style and historical moment, right? So we've got some essays that deal with music going back to the 40s and 50s, some essays that are dealing with contemporary music. You know, my own essay on subwoofers really deals with stuff that's happening right now. Cultures, different genres, everything from country to EDM to death metal, you know, all over the place.
Okay, great. So I do want to know about your title. So why don't we go back and can you just tell us where that title came from? Because it's pretty striking.
Sure. Well, The Relentless Pursuit of Tone is the masthead motto of a guitar magazine called Premier Guitar. And Premier Guitar is, I guess what you'd call a kind of, it's a trade journal for professional guitarists, which is also read by what they call hobbyists, right? So it's a guitar magazine, and it's a little more serious, if you will, than the ones that you might find on typical, like, supermarket, at least in Hollywood, you find them. Typical supermarket, you know, racks. So there are some very, very general magazines like Guitar World or Guitar Player. But Premier Guitar is really read, actually, by professional guitarists. And its motto, you know, like the New York Times has all the news that's fit to print, right? So the motto of Premier Guitar is The Relentless Pursuit of Tone. So to me, this was... that was the name of the seminar, you know, and I loved it because it points out just how central this kind of very complex concept of tone is to the social role of being a guitarist. You know, that's what this magazine, which is about, you know, everything guitarists do. So they didn't say the relentless pursuit of the right notes or something, or, you know, the relentless pursuit of the C major scale. No, it's tone. So evidently, like, that's what people are worried about. And also this idea that your life as a musician would be a relentless pursuit of some receding perfection of tone, you know, that you'd never get it right, started to give a sense of how, in a way, mysterious this concept of tone is. The fact that it has some ideological contradictions in it. Yeah, I stole their masthead motto for the title of the book because I wanted to, I wanted to signal that there's something kind of, kind of Moby Dick-like about the concept of tone. You know, people get very obsessive about it, and it's a term of ideology. And if you could sort of dig into that ideology, you might have your hands on a very kind of important aspect of popular music that musicology has not, up until now, really done a great job dealing with. One of the things that we talk about in the book, in the introduction and in the afterword, is we're sort of at a transitional moment. It has been, if anybody who wrote about the question of tone and timbre in music in general, and certainly in pop music, would normally start off, well, musicology doesn't have a very good language for talking about tone. We don't really know how to do this, right? It's considered to be a secondary parameter as opposed to the primary parameters of pitch and then rhythm. And so as a secondary parameter, it doesn't have its own analytical language. It's hard to talk about with any kind of precision. And thus, it doesn't get talked about as much in scholarly literature. And so there was a way that our relentless pursuit of tone also had to do with sort of musicology, or our group of musicologists sort of pursuing tone as something to talk about and to sort of pin down insofar as you could.
In your introduction, you say, "The relentless pursuit of tone seeks to bridge the gap between timbre and tone, illuminating how the materiality of sound structures cultural practice." Can you say a little bit more about this? Why is this important?
Well, yeah, that the dialectic, if you will, the dichotomy between tone and timbre is actually a crucial kind of structuring feature of, if you will, the larger discourse around the sound of pop music. So yeah, I mean, we spend quite a bit of time in the introduction talking first about tone and then about timbre. And at one level, in a very kind of almost simple level, the two words point to two sides of what we have tended to call an emergent phenomenon. So that the thing we're talking about is sort of emerges out of the interaction of a lot of different kinds of social structures, physics, a whole network of complicated sort of concepts. And roughly speaking, the way we think of it is that tone is actually well, let's go the other way. Timbre is the more sort of, if you will, scientific side of the question. So timbre becomes, in a way, the kind of thing that you could theoretically get your hands around by looking at a spectrogram or a some kind of analytical measurement of the actual sound waves. This is a little confusing because in acoustics and in the scientific world, the two terms are in the opposite relationship. If you talk to scientists, they'll say tone is literally just the sound waves. So you have tones, and then timbre is the thing in your brain. But roughly speaking, we were thinking, okay, we didn't really worry about the sort of just pure physics of tones that people, you know, vibrations in the air. But we did talk about, okay, timbre is the way scientists talk about the emergence of some kind of structure in your mind as a perceptual structure. We can talk more about that. Tone is a socially mediated construct, right? So tone, at least in the way that it's used in guitar magazines, the thing that people are relentlessly pursuing is actually what happens when timbre and all of its complicated connections between the physical facts of acoustics and the perceptual apparatus in the mind, all that stuff then connects up with values and goals and aesthetic positions that people take in actual music making. So as a kind of cultural musicologist, this is sort of my thing, I'm interested in tone. because to me, tone is one of those great words like swing, mm-hmm. or, you know, that it is inherently contradictory, and there's a strong mystification discourse around it. So in the introduction, we wrote that in pieces. So there's a section that I wrote about the idea that, you know, people, tone is sort of like a mystery. It's very mystified, and people are very happy to tell you sort of weirdly Zen kind of koan type things, you know, tone is everywhere and nowhere, or, you know, like tone, you know, tone, where is tone? And there, you know, tone is tone in the fingers of the musician, you know, or is tone somehow in the devices that you hook up between your guitar and the amplifier? Where does the tone come from? You know, people go on tone quests, you know, like people analogize shopping, which is what it is. It's basically shopping for, you know, more toys to attach to your guitar, as a kind of quest, like in Lord of the Rings, you know, to find the, you know, the whatever it is, you know, the magic ring or whatever. So tone becomes a very mystified concept. Thus culturally fascinating, that on the one level, I think I say something like this, that the word, the tone is actually just indexes the confusion about musicality in certain kinds of popular music, that tone is at one level the way the way your expressiveness as a musician comes out. Like, he has an amazing tone. Why? Well, probably not just because he bought all this gear. Even though the guitar magazines that talk about tone exist to sell that gear, right? They'll always back off in their editorial and sort of say, well, no, you can't just buy the gear and then magically have the tone. Even although if you turn the page in the magazine, you'll see an ad that says, own your tone. You know, buy this thing and you'll own your own tone. So there's this really interesting contradiction between a pretty serious sales pitch that says you can buy this device and have tone, so the tone is kind of an inherent property of a guitar pickup or an effects pedal or whatever it is. And then in the editorial part of the magazine, people pulling back away from that, resisting the idea that tone can simply be purchased, that it has to have something to do with your really, really squishy concepts like musicality and mojo and all that stuff. So yeah, tone, to my mind, of the two, is the socially mediated term. And timbre, in a sense, indexes the part of the book which really does try to deal responsibly with the psychoacoustics of musical sound. So one of the signature things I think about this collection is that it moves back and forth pretty seamlessly between culturally, theoretical and cultural perspectives on tone as a kind of, what I would say, tone as a sort of node within a discourse. And then on the other hand, timbre as a kind of psychoacoustic reality. And so a lot of the essays, when they're really working, will be talking about a particular genre or an artist or a track or a sound as a cultural phenomenon, what kind of meanings it accretes, how it relates to complicated structures of race, class, and gender, politics, at the same time as it's trying to pay attention to the timbral aspect, i.e. really precise description of the actual acoustic issues that it raises. To take an example, this is probably the best example. We have an essay in the book on twang, the notion of twang in country music, right? And twang is like, you can imagine, twang is like tone. if you think about what twang is, on the one hand, there can be a twang in your voice. There's a twang on your banjo. There can be a twang in the guitar. And there's a sense that if you understood what twang was, then you would understood what country is. And in a certain kind of ruralness, a certain way of speaking, which connects up to a whole kind of worldview, politics, probably class relationships, mm-hmm. right? At the same time, twang is an onomatopoetic word which appears to index a certain kind of attack decay structure on a stringed instrument. And so in the essay on twang, Jocelyn Neal, who is one of the probably big, best, one of the major experts on sort of on country music, does a spectral analysis of what a banjo note sounds like. So her thesis is, in a way, twang is a way of talking about a kind of sound, a shape of a sound that comes from the banjo with its particular kind of sharp attack, quick decay. And her essay attempts to move from that sort of timbral analysis of the banjo twang. So here is the shape of the sound, here are its characteristics, to the larger cultural question of what does it mean to be twangy and what kind of politics and class and race and all that stuff comes out of that. So yeah, we at the heart of the essays is usually some, and I'm sorry, I'm making a kind of gesture with my hands where I, you know, connect up two fingers, you know, like there's a kind of intersection or a linking up between a timbral set of questions, which are very technical, and then tonal questions, which are very cultural. And I think that's, if I were to pitch the collection to people who are not, you know, like psychoacousticians, that there's never going to be an essay which is just about sort of like vibrating strings and your ear and, you know, kind of Fourier transforms and all that. There'll be some of that in most of the essays, but then there'll be cultural interpretation of the results, which is, yeah, I mean, that's why we were able to get Simon Frith to do the afterword. I mean, I think he was intrigued by the kind of social implications of tone.
So in thinking about twang, or in thinking about Walmark's essay on death metal and the brutal tone of death metal, this relationship between tone and, let's say, authenticity in a range of genres and music scenes comes up a lot in the book. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, sure. I think this is sort of the tension I was talking about before, that there's a strong tension in the discourse around tone and timbre in pop music because it's so highly mediated by technology, and because popular music is a commercial music and one of the ancillary, very commercialized parts of the popular music ecosystem is instruments, right? There is a strong anxiety about authentic tone, right? And in some cases, and I think Zach Walmark's essay on death metal, and perhaps my own on the subwoofer, there is an interesting phenomenon where extremity of tone or timbre becomes a kind of way to buttress authenticity. So what Zach points out in his death metal essay is that there are a specific set of playing techniques, down-tuning the guitar very, very far, adding lower strings below the lowest string to get this extreme sound. And there's a way in which if the sound is truly extreme, then it has a kind of authenticity, even though it's done through what you might call tricks. One of the really interesting things about Zach's essay is most of the extreme sounds that occur in death metal, sort of that sort of throat ripping scream that people do. I'll spare you. I won't do it actually. And you know, the kind of completely distorted kind of, you know, droning sound of the guitar. They're actually technical tricks. Like you, even things like the kind of blasting beats of a lot of extreme metal where the drummer seems to be on methamphetamines. A lot of those are actually done with MIDI. They're actually programmed. So there's always this contradiction where you can analyze death metal as a series of, if you will, tricks. A really good death metal vocalist can do that sort of monster roar scream thing and then turn around and, you know, drink a glass of water and just talk totally normally. It's a technique. And also you can buy the guitar, which has the lower string. You can down tune the string. You can do what those guys do, and it can be done almost mechanically. But there's something about the extremity of the sound in and of itself that gives it a kind of non-negotiable power, right? So like, if you're a death metal guitarist and you're like, look, everybody else is tuning their guitars down to, I'll pick an arbitrary note, they tune down to B. And you're like, well, we tune down to A. You know, we tune down lower. That you can't argue with that. And that has a kind of authenticity to it. And the same thing with the bass culture that I talk about in my essay on the subwoofer, that there's a very strong feeling that the lower the bass, the more real it is. So that the extreme low sounds in, you know, genres like dubstep, drum and bass, reggae, dancehall music, the bass frequencies that are so low that you can barely hear them and that actually register more as almost touching you as a haptic experience. You know, there are tricks to produce those as well, you know. But yet I think people get excited and they think there's something kind of fundamentally real and authentic about just a particular kind of timbre. So certain timbres have been given a lot of power as being authentic timbres. I think partially because they are extreme. So yeah, that connects up Zach's essay and mine, which I think is a nice connection. On the other hand, we do have a couple of essays where people are very obviously worrying about it. I guess the most classic one in this case is Steve Waxman, who is, you know, as I said earlier, sort of the guy on electric guitar, decided to do an essay for us on a very much despised instrument, the guitar synthesizer, right? The whole problem of the guitar synthesizer, is it's connected to a style of music which has a real serious PR problem, which is jazz fusion, you know, rock jazz fusion of the 70s and 80s. So it's a kind of music that people think of as sort of inauthentic. But the real problem with the guitar synthesizer is that it's impossible to imagine its mode of production of tone as being authentic, because the guitar is simply sending MIDI signals to a computer somewhere. So you can, on the one hand, have any sound you want, right? That's the power of it, right? Theoretically, a guitarist could use his guitar, and it's usually a hymn, I have to say, to trigger any kind of sounds, which is a powerful sort of progressivist thing to be able to do. But the problem is it seems just hopelessly inauthentic, because your tone has nothing to do with the actual instrument you're playing. So I would say that although we don't thematize this, there's a kind of sense that if you think of your instrument as a controller, right, as a controller device, then you're far away from the kind of discourse that we're talking about in the book, where most people think of their instruments as actually having the tone in them somehow. Because the world we're talking about is the world where, you know, people sort of fetishize sound, and it's the connection of the sound to the physical objects that they are working with that gives them this kind of authenticity, as opposed to a kind of more, you know, Bell Labs kind of thing, where you're really more interested in innovation and flexibility and kind of abstraction of tone. So, yeah, I mean, the physicality of tone becomes one way that it becomes authentic. Like, this device only does one thing. And it's a physical object that's designed to do that one thing, and you really can't get it to do anything else. That feels like authentic. And the voice, you know, if we want to do a little shift here, the voice is probably the primal model of that. You know, your throat is really not adjustable. Or you can't swap out different larynxes to see if you can get a better sound, right? You work with what you have. So your voice is you. And the question of voice and identity, there's a whole section of the book where we separate voice out as a special kind of instrument, which really connects up to identity in a very strong sense. I mean, tone does connect up to identity. And I think guitar players, when they're holding the axe that they're associated with, have a kind of identity. You know, there's a standard thing that, like, somebody can play one note and you can tell who they are. You know, that kind of sense that their individuality comes through in their tone. But with voice, that's, you know, sort of the whole discourse is dominated by that.
That essay on Jimmy Scott by Nina Eichheim, that one also talks a lot about voice and identity.
Well, and I mean, that's that whole section. I mean, it's flanked by an essay by Mark Samples, which is on, if you will, the sort of intellectual property aspects of the voice, right? So we have an essay in terms where the question of do you own your vocal timbre, and you can't really copyright it, but is there some legal way that you can protect it? And it turns out, yes, there have been at least one or two successful litigations where it's been legally established that people's identity can be, in a sense, counterfeited by counterfeiting their vocal tone, right? So, you know, the law now says, yes, if you copy somebody's way of singing, you in effect are in an ad, because this is what happens. Like, if you find someone to be a Bette Midler imitator or imitate Carlos Santana's guitar tone in an ad, the legal strategy for trying to stop that was to say, effectively, you have stolen these people's identity, right? And you're fooling people into thinking that these people are endorsing the product when they're not. So it's actually false advertising. And that legal strategy. So on the one hand, we have a nice analysis in the book of how that works, how the law has fallen out in terms of you being able to protect your distinctive way of singing. But of course, the Jimmy Scott example is much more extreme, because this is a person who is really Jimmy Scott's identity is pretty much unique. You know, he does not really fit any of the normal gender binaries, and especially the way those gender binaries cut through singing, you know, so that we have a set of, I mean, if I, it's a really, really interesting essay, and it's very characteristic of Nina's work. She's, you know, she's done really serious analysis along all sorts of identity formation lines, you know, race and the like. But the thing she wrote for us is largely about kind of confusions of gender and sexuality. The point being, Jimmy Scott, because of a glandular disorder, you know, is biologically male, but has a voice that is actually was consistently very difficult to place in terms of gender. It was too high to be a male voice, but not quite structured the same way as a female voice. It didn't really sound like a man singing in falsetto, or, you know, sometimes people would analogize him to a castrato. So it was a literally unclassifiable voice, because this is a person who's physically unique. They had a actual kind of, they were physically different. And what Nina analyzes in the essay is the very complex ways in which this really beautifully talented singer, because it's a unique instrument that is in that guy's throat, plus he has actually, you know, turned out to have an incredible musical talent. And so his career is a very complicated thing, right? You know, there's a way in which sometimes he was sort of a novelty. There's a lot of complicated ways in which, because he had a very long career, which spanned from the 50s into the 80s. In the early part of his career, you can see that record companies don't know how to really market this guy. And there are complicated, you know, that Nina does a really nice analysis of an album cover where she points out that, like, it's not clear that how to position this man, you know, that he doesn't show up on the album cover sometimes, so that there's a deliberate kind of confusion about, well, what is the body that connects up to this really unearthly kind of a voice that doesn't sound like any other voice. And there are situations where, you know, Jimmy Scott is singing love songs, right, on an album, but there's three people on the album cover, like a woman and like two guys. And one of them might be him, but there has to be another guy there who's like more of a man, you know, very complicated kind of stuff. And then later on, what's incredibly useful for Nina is that Jimmy Scott becomes this sort of, one at the climactic moment of the original Twin Peaks, David Lynch's Twin Peaks, this sort of haunting voice becomes, you know, a mystical symbol. So, yeah, I mean, Jimmy Scott is, on the one hand, a kind of, I don't say it's a tragic story, but it's a little bit of a tricky story in that he was so difficult to fit into the gender and race and sexuality roles that his career was definitely stunted by that. But on the other hand, there's a kind of transcendent moment where at least one great artist, David Lynch, found a way to actually use this slipperiness of identity, this impossible to pin down vocal identity, as a symbol of like the ultimate, you know, the transcendent at the end of Twin Peaks, you know, one of the great sort of moments of underscoring or, you know, music supervision there's ever been.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your chapter on bass tone?
Sure. I think that the working title for that chapter as I was writing it was The Timbre of No Timbre. Because what I was interested in, I mean, it came out of my work on electronic dance music. So at some very basic level, one of the distinctive timbres of dance music is that very deep sub bass. But it's a kind of timbre that it whose distinctive, one of is a timbre, one of whose distinctions is that at the bottom end, it shades off into something that you don't really hear as much as feel. At least that's the claim. So there's a way that it's a timbre that isn't a timbre, because it stops being processed by the ear and starts being processed by the body. At least that's the claim. And I became fascinated by the tone aspect of this sort of non-timbral timbre. If you know, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Some of what goes on in my chapter is to actually exhaustively try to talk about the actual, how those deep low tones are produced. How do subwoofers actually work? Because it's a technically complex thing. And I think I'm the only one in the collection who actually talks about effectively a speaker as an instrument, right? So most everybody else is either talking about voice or about things that you would recognize as a musical instrument that you play. And one of the things I did was actually treat the subwoofer in the context of like a sound system, like a Jamaican sound system, or as an instrument. And one of the things that I found to be really kind of cool was if you go and do the research on how sound systems are actually constructed, there's a very, and I'm going to use the air quotes, imagine air quotes in your mind, musical. There's a very musical way of thinking about the deepest bass register. I actually analogized it to orchestration, you know, what composers do when they layer different kinds of instruments. So if you're listening to a big sort of EDM sound system out in a field somewhere, you're probably listening to 8-16 different subwoofers of probably 3 or 4 different types, each of which has a particular kind of frequency response and a strength and a weakness. And they're combined together to create a kind of, to cover various ranges in this deepest bass register. And so I spent a lot of time in that essay talking about how subwoofers are built, the different types of them, where in the space below 100 hertz down to the bottom of hearing range, which is somewhere around like 15, 18 hertz, each speaker works, and how you would create a kind of, for various different genres, how you would create the bass sound you want. So on the one hand, there's that sort of technical stuff, but my essay also deals with what we would call like the tone aspect, sort of like the discourse around deep bass, because there's a lot of very, let's just say very dramatic claims made for the political power of deep bass. It's kind of like, as I said, it's like the kind of discourse around extremity in metal, right? So that the deeper the bass and the heavier the bass, the more real it seems to people. So there's a kind of way in which you get people talking about bass culture and effectively claiming that very deep bass frequencies are more real, they're more interesting, they're more politically resistant than sort of boring frequencies in the mid-range of the spectrum. So that's what you might, I mean, some people actually even talk about a politics of frequency, you know, that depending on where you are in the frequency spectrum of our hearing, you have a kind of political implication. And bass, you know, bass is like power, you know, and it's also kind of, it's connected up to all kinds of complicated and slightly problematic ideas about Africa and resistance and, you know, kind of dystopian sort of power fantasies and the like, utopian and dystopian power fantasies. So just as in the introduction, we spent a certain amount of time deconstructing the ideology of guitar tone, showing how it was contradictory, that it's important that it both be something that's inherent to you, but also something you can buy, You know, the question of deep bass in dance music, on the one hand, it is fetishized almost as kind of much more real than other kinds of frequencies. But, you know, when you actually come to examine how the deepest bass frequencies work, a lot of the fantasies about bass culture sort of evaporate. You know, for instance, I want to reassure anyone who's listening to this podcast, it's not possible to find a very loud, low frequency that will cause your colon to spasm and create the brown sound. Okay. I've done the research and I can reassure you that does not happen. One of the things I found is that, like when you feel the bass all over your body, you think, oh, wow, it's vibrating my whole body. It's not. It's actually vibrating only the top millimeter of your skin, right? So the whole body sensation of bass hitting you, it turns out the research has been done. If you want to be a hard ass, you can read the Journal of Low Frequency Noise, which is, you know, not one of the most exciting journals, but it has a lot of good information in it. People do research where they actually have sort of shown when you hit people with low bass from big subwoofers, yes, it does. You do get a whole body, what you would call haptic, kind of tactile experience, but it does not penetrate even a half an inch into your body. It's all about your skin being moved very so slightly by the sound waves. So this whole notion that somehow you're being vibrated through, your whole body is being kind of stirred up, is a fantasy. It does connect up nicely with other places where tone becomes a kind of mystery or magic word, which tries to do all this negotiation between how sounds are actually made and what they're supposed to do in the world, right? And their kind of power culturally. So yeah, I got very heavily into it. And I may follow that up some.
Were there any major surprises in any of the essays that you read? Did you learn anything unexpected?
Well, I would have to say, I almost in every case, I would say one of the big surprises was in the auto-tune essay itself. Catherine Provenzano is a very, very smart young scholar working to finish up her dissertation. And she took what you might call an ethnographic approach towards auto-tune. Where she, of course, learned about the actual software, because the focus on auto-tune is usually a focus about sort of de-skilling and automation, right? And sort of a kind of robot future, that auto-tune is a piece of software that turns everybody into a robot and kind of destroys the skill of musicianship. Now anybody can pretend to sing and it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And what the two things that you learn from Catherine's article is, one, when you're aware of auto-tune, in other words, when you go, oh, wow, listen to that auto-tune, you're aware of the tip of the iceberg, mm-hmm. right? Basically, for every track where you can hear that strong auto-tune, there's thousands of tracks where auto-tune was used, but you can't hear it. So one of the things is that, no, that there's a whole culture of people who use auto-tune in such a way as to make it completely invisible. And that is considered to be a highly skilled professional talent. So the thing that was surprising is that auto-tune seems to stand in people's minds for the demusicalization of music, right? Now the algorithm now makes everything musical. But that's not the way people think about it in the business. In fact, to be a skilled auto-tune engineer and to be able to use the software is actually a kind of musicality. So I found that to be very interesting. And her essay actually does a wonderful thing where she takes the example of T-Pain, who became sort of the whipping boy for the auto-tune effect, and shows, again, this kind of idea that it's about tone, i.e. it's about ideology and race, class, and all that stuff, that she ends her essay with the sort of recuperation of T-Pain by NPR. He does a tiny desk concert where he sings in his real voice and suddenly all is forgiven, right? So that this kind of notion that that after, and what's interesting is after you've read her whole essay and you realize, oh no, you know, music, it is not about the elimination of musical labor. It's about the redistribution of musical labor. There has to be somebody who knows how to get the pitches right. It's just shifting from one set of musicians to another. Then there's a poignancy about T-Pain sort of taking his power back and showing that, yes, I can actually sing. And then people were like, oh, I get it. So all that auto-tune stuff was then a kind of progressive electronic music thing. And yeah, so the essay on auto-tune had some really nice flips in it. And as I said earlier, I knew I wanted something on auto-tune because when we were thinking about putting the book together, that was right at the heart of the kind of auto-tune, you know, scandal, shall we say. I'm trying to think if there's another one that really flips things very intensively. No, I think that was probably the most surprising one. I will say I was a little surprised by what I found. I mean, I surprised myself in the idea that most of what I thought, what you tend to think about the physicality of deep bass, sub bass reverberations, turns out to be not true. Like, it's a lot of fantasy, and in fact, there's a huge amount of a huge superstructure built up on very, very small physical effects. So, yeah.
In the afterword, Simon Frith responds to the assertion that you make in the intro about the impact of tone on culture as follows, quote, "The point is not just that, quote, the materiality of sound structures cultural practice, unquote, but also that the cultural practice of sound making structures what we hear and what we mean by the materiality of sound." What do you make of his response?
Well, I mean, his afterword is, to my mind, it's why you want to buy the book. He does what you're supposed to do in an afterword, which is he reacts to all of the essays and sort of effectively the book comes with its own review, which is nice. But yes, one of his perspectives is as, you know, somebody who comes from more of the British, you know, popular music sociology side, the sort of Birmingham school type stuff. And so I think for him, that reversal, it's really about, we're all traversing the same kind of path, but the question of where you start and where you end up, I think defines your disciplinarity. So, you know, because this book is put together by musicologists, culturally interested musicologists, but musicologists nonetheless, it tends to start from some sonic phenomenon. Right. And I guess in a sense, then whether we consciously are meant to do this or not, that gives you a certain causal chain where, yes, you're sort of doing sonic determinism, that certain sounds can be made by these objects. And then that sort of determines a kind of cultural field or cultural sort of effects. And we sort of, we did, I think, because at some, at least one of the co-editors, Zach, is very heavily into, in his own work, the kind of psychoacoustics of sound. This is one of the things he works on. We did sort of think that, yes, effectively you're beginning with timbre moving through tone and ultimately getting to sort of culture. So what you hear determines what you think. And I think Simon very correctly, points out that something we all would assent to, which is that just as with it's sort of like the linguistic turn, like what you think determines what you can hear. You know, which is completely true. So that, and I think that he's, and I tell you, of course, because, you know, one reacts to the sound of one's own name, right? I mean, I remember quite clearly what he said about my essay, which I thought was, you know, which I thought was actually very, he pointed out that, yeah, effectively, I had chosen I was arguing that, how would I put this? That basically people were hearing kind of phantom effects. That they knew what they wanted the sub-bass to do or be, and that actually determines their understanding of what the musical material is. Because when I actually went in from the other side through like very, very kind of dry audio engineering stuff and psychoacoustics, I found out that all the things that people thought were there are literally not there. You know, that like, ooh, this effect that happens. No, actually it doesn't, you know, like the infamous Brown sound, right? Like the fantasies about what the sound can do to you, like what's materially happening, are actually determined culturally before you even hear anything. So yeah, I think that perspective is very useful. And I think it probably indexes the difference between somebody who effectively is coming at music from a sociological social science perspective, a kind of, you know, that music is does a certain kind of work in culture. Music is a thing that you do. And it is probably true that Simon, although I think he really liked the book in general, we're grateful for that, was picking out of it the moments where we were actually critiquing some of our own. Our essays turn out to be a form of self-critique where, although we all, I think, started with, hey, sound is really interesting and musical sound in its organized form is really cool, let's start there, see what's, quote, really going on. And then that'll give us a sense of how to understand the cultural formations that are built on top of it. And, you know, I think Simon's pointing out there's a certain amount of foundationalism there. Like you're assuming that that you can get a kind of unambiguous kind of scientific understanding of how sounds work on you, how timbre works. When in fact, you cannot, you know, you cannot hear these sounds outside of culture. So I thought that was, you know, it's a really nice kind of framing thing that he does at the end there.
Well, Robert, we've taken up a lot of your time. I have a final question for you. What are you working on now?
Well, one of the things that I am working on is It's a tragic thing when you're the editor of the collection and you have to cut your own essay by large numbers of words. Because I got so into the subwoofer thing that and the larger question of the loudspeaker one of the things I'm interested in doing is I recently became aware through an interview on this network. So that's a pitch for listening to a lot of podcasts. That there is a series called Object Lessons out of the Atlantic and Bloomsbury, where people write, you know, about an object. And it seemed to me that my take on the subwoofer for this book was actually it had a certain kind of ideological take about about this notion of tone. In other words, the kind of cultural notion of tone. But it seems to me to talk about subwoofers as objects would be a really kind of interesting possibility, because they are fascinating objects. And this would be, to some extent, to pick up Simon's point and say, well, like, let's actually just talk about these things, these tools that allow people to do things, kind of the affordances. So I'm thinking about maybe trying to use some of the words that got left on the table and maybe scratch my itch to really talk just about subwoofers as objects and as a kind of culturally powerful object that, you know, index, you know, the shortest version of this, and this is work in progress, is you could, there have been some very interesting studies of the Walkman and personal stereo, right? And the earbud speaker as a kind of icon of convenience and portability. Well, the subwoofer is the opposite of all that, right? It's, if the earbud speakers are efficient and convenient, you know, subwoofers are wasteful and inconvenient, and they are sort of, they connect up to a social experience of music, which is the opposite of the kind of atomized listening of the personal stereo. So I'm playing around with that. There are other projects on the docket that are more sort of, if you will, my day job, which is to do kind of structural analysis of popular music. I have a couple of projects floating around. I'm interested in working on working on the DJ set as a kind of aesthetic object. I teach a course on the history of electronic dance music. It's always been tempting to think, well, is there a book to be written about EDM? A number of people have done it. But I found myself more interested in saying, maybe I want to actually concentrate on, if you will, what is the question of a work or a thing that you can talk about in this history. And it seems to me that in my teaching, some of the most exciting moments is talking about the structure of a whole DJ set. Don't do it very often, but when you do it, it is a very powerful kind of analytical question. And so it occurred to me that I might try to find a finite number of historically important DJ sets and do what I would say is a kind of old-fashioned musicology on them. In other words, to treat them like albums or like symphonies and really ask how that they are put together. Because, and that would be a kind of a self-consciously retro thing to do. So I'm playing around with some issues in electronic music seeing where those things go.
Well, Robert, these sound like great projects. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Bye-bye.